All right, so thank you, Cynthia, for taking some time to talk with Heather and I. We know there's a lot of interest and conversation in the larger community about this topic of evil, and we wanted to take some time to include the larger community by having a conversation with you and going through some questions. So we will jump in. We know that Rebecca Parker kind of initiated this conversation because she had some folks in Atlanta that were interested. But we were curious about what sparked in you that has you interested in delving into this material and doing these wisdom schools, these series of wisdom schools.
Well, it really did actually start with Rebecca. I had another thing that I thought I was pursuing that winter, for my topics. But when she raised it as a as an issue and saying the people in our group at Mary and Martha's Place, our wisdom circle, are really interested in this, could you tell me a reading list that you would read to teach this course? So I started thinking about the books and I watched how it sort of popped into mind. And then I thought, hey, I could teach this course. And then I thought, hey, well, why don't I? And one of the things that I like about the Atlanta group, one of the things about being a far-flung network, is that you've got all these wonderful little pockets of color. And in Atlanta, they've got a marvelous kind of interface between a long-standing woman wisdom group working out of Mary and Martha's Place, which Rebecca really superintends, with a lot of background and wisdom. But as you all know, Atlanta is a very, very hot transitional place politically. People are politically savvy. The state is shifting its demographics. And when Rebecca's husband, Buddy, and I taught our course in civics for wisdom students, it just played bigger there than anywhere in the network. People got what we were trying to do. And Atlanta has this kind of funny mix of being able to behold the sobriety and the reality of the current political situation from a wisdom perspective without getting torn into, World 48 talk, conversation, polarization. And they're very, very keen that way. So I found that it's often a very good place to pay attention to when you begin to get prompts from what on the ground works. And I know that a lot of people for the past couple of years, I mean, we've been in a tunnel since 2016 in America, that, with one thing after another, with the wherever you stood on the where however you voted in the elections in 2016, the ensuing 4 years with Donald Trump changed the nature. It's like it turned upside down basic standards that people figured of civility, of kindness, of honesty, God knows. And then on top of that, COVID and this whole polarization of suspicions, paranoid theories, QAnon, that people began to really experience, and particularly in as the mental breakdowns and anguish intensified as people got stuck at home and in COVID and global warming escalated and grandkids were saying, is it really safe to have babies anymore? It's like people are beginning to say, is the planet in the hands of some intelligently malevolent forces? Is this all just happenstance and garden variety neurosis? Or is there something called evil that took shape? And of course, we threw out evil about, 50 years ago in theology. We decided evil was basically just the result of neurosis, writ large, people being hurt and wounded and victimized, and there wasn't really evil, there was just suffering people. And we tried to take big, large steps, at least in progressive Christianity, away from this kind of dark force mentality. But at the same time, there was this real sense of, you know, are we dealing with just human powers? Or are we just dealing with human bad actors, you know, human bubbas? Or are we got, you know, are we tangling with something bigger? And if so, let's come back and take a second look. So I thought this was very important conversation for people to have, and I was happy to encourage it and to leap into it myself.
That's really helpful, Cynthia. And you've already started to touch into this in what you just said, but you know, there's so many preconceived ideas and formatory thinking around the idea of evil and reactivity in people's nervous systems. So we're wondering if you can say a little bit more about what you mean when you're talking about evil in ourselves, others, in systems. You know, is there a lexicon you can give us, or how you would define evil?
Well, let me start by just saying a word about formatory thinking, because that may be a word that not everybody out here in our readership understands, because the term itself came from the Gurdjieff work. But it basically talks about the kind of thinking that happens when you just absorb ready-made pieces of information from other sources without having personally grounded them in their in your being. And so reformatory thinking is recycled thinking, one-centered thinking, and kind of socially conditioned thinking. So there's high-end, or, you know, we like to think that formatory thinking is thinking in cliches, and you like to immediately blame the, you know, the Fox News crowd for formatory thinking. But formatory thinking is just as rampant in the people who are liberal progressives. We have formatory thinking about diet. We have formatory thinking about victim psychology nowadays. We have formatory thinking about being alone. That's not good. We have formatory thinking about, just everything. And it's as insidious on the progressive side of a social spectrum as on the left side. Whenever you're borrowing anybody else's thinking, moving it in, we have a lot of formatory thinking around AA, around wellness, around recoverment. So much of our actual experience and structuring of the world in World 48, the world we live in, is formatory thinking. And there are two big weak links in formatory thinking. First of all, because it hasn't been personally experienced and validated in your whole being, it tends to be inflexible and easily defensive. So if you push a button, it plays a whole tape. And this is true left and right. And it's some of the biggest problems I've had to deal with the liberal progressive side of my Christian community, that are doing fine until you run afoul of some sort of new age cliche, you know, some sort of truism about how people are, about science, about victim, about, you know, abusers, about, you know, anything that we've got formatory thinking about. So it's pervasive. And to get beyond formatory thinking is not just a matter of waking up. It's a matter of waking up in all three centers. So having said that, it's a classic device of Western philosophical tradition to start by defining something. And I don't think that that's actually the most useful approach to do it, because people will, in their formatory ways, they're going to want to say, well, what is it? Who is it? Is there this kind of evil? Is there that kind of evil? And once we know what the name of the beast is, then we can go out and attack it. This is not going to work. And I once had when I was taking music history and appreciation with a very gifted high school teacher, we were learning a new vocabulary word, cadence. And I couldn't understand what it meant. I went to Grove's Dictionary of Music and tried to read it. And it talked about a concluding formula so that one knew that it was, you know, I learned all the words. I couldn't make sense. I said, help, I don't understand it. And the teacher went over to the piano and with his hands there, he played the chords that go, da-dum, that's a cadence. Anybody in the planet knows that when you hear a piece go, da-dum, da-dum, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- words. The words were just hog-tying it because the experience is in your bones. So with those kinds of disclaimers in mind, that I like to start with Scott Peck's wonderful definition in People of the Lie. One of the books that immediately came to my mind is one that we ought to be looking at in the course, that he says it's any force, either internal or external, and he doesn't weigh in about that, which deliberately seeks to kill or kill the liveliness, destroy life or destroy liveliness in another human being. And destroying life is obvious. Destroying liveliness is interesting, because what he means is these pervasive attempts to diminish people, to suck their energy, to decrease their vitality, to decrease their confidence. This fits in the ballpark that he calls evil. And Scott Peck started out very much a kind of classic psychologist back in the late 70s and 80s, thinking, oh, it's just all neurosis. It's all basically has a human matrix. And by the time he'd finished, he'd taken a big step further in the direction of saying, well, wherever it seeds itself, that you are dealing, when you get full-blown evil, with forces that are greater and stronger than garden variety, woundedness, and hurt. It has more configuration. So he didn't weigh in on whether it's an external force or an internal force, but he did weigh in very strongly on its malevolent intent and its malevolent intent to suck life from another. And so when I started playing with that and fine-tuning that definition, I don't have my notes right in front of me, but I said that it was first of all, a intentional, repeated, habitual pattern that would lead to the doing. And I would call evil an act, not a character trait, not a generic kind of state, because evil is as evil acts. And what I was trying to suggest as I worked with this part of the definition is that virtually all of us in life have murderous fantasies. You know, somebody makes you good and mad, you say, God, I like to take them apart brick by brick. But there's a huge difference between, you know, having these emotions wash over you and acting out of them, and not just acting out of them in some sort of a just what the law calls crime of passion, where you just lose it and you explode, but where you deliberately take it to the step in some way of saying, I'm going to injure this person, I'm going to hurt it, so it's a repeated action that creates this diminishment of life and liveliness in another. So that's basically the ballpark I work in. I haven't spent a lot of time yet in my own explorations of this, working with systemic evil versus individual evil, because while I think it's clear that there is such a thing as systemic evil built into organizations, and I would tend to say into all organizations, the capacity is there. That although that's there, and although we know that governments and corporations and all manner of other structures do perpetrate systemic evil within themselves, I find from the wisdom perspective, it's more important to understand how evil germinates, you know, how a human soul becomes dispensable, as they say in French, at the disposal of kind of malevolent trajectories of steamrolling action. How do we give into it? How do we become swept away in it? And I think that you have to really look at the principle of enthrallment. And you see enthrallment beginning early on. You have to look at things from the individual. And from there on, you can see systemic evil as individuals, the whole process taken to a new scale. But I find practically that when we start talking about systemic evil, like in government, like in corporations, what you wind up with is with people very mad and very polarized and spewing conspiracy theory. They don't lend themselves to productive conversations. And I've seen that over and over and over again, trying to deal with the question of evil with really good idealistic people, working at it with World 48 tools and sensibilities.
Yeah, thank you for that, Cynthia, the clarifications there. You know, at the Wisdom School in Claymont, you talked about a new map in regards to evil that included structures of consciousness from Gebser and from Gurdjieff, the worlds, the different worlds. I wonder if you can speak to this new map and how this understanding offers a different way to encounter evil.
Well, I think so. And I'm particularly excited about the Gebser map, because most everybody, when they talk about evil today, begins from a philosophical or a pastoral clinical standpoint, but they want to know about the ontology of evil. Is God good or evil? Is there an evil force? Was evil built into the cosmos? And what Gebser allows you to do with his wonderful sort of mapping of the structures of consciousness as they successively emerge into full societal, you know, form, actualization, and then transcend and include. But as you look at it, there is a point in time in the history of the evolution of human consciousness, at least as we track it in the greater West, when awareness of evil as evil entered. And before that, it was not on people's radar screen, because the structure of their consciousness was not designed to incorporate it. And it's fairly clear. I read through his whole 500 plus page tome and looked at the table of contents, and there's not a single entry for evil. It's not like he doesn't talk about it, but that this was so sort of crazy that I said, well, what's going on here? But as you follow the history of how he unfolds it, what we would call our whole consciousness, our ontology, our philosophy, our theology of evil, the capacity to think in that term entered at the beginning, the very early headwaters of what he would call the mental structure of consciousness, which is the same structure that we're now occupying 2,500 years later at the tail end of it. And this is significant. Before then, in the mythic structure of consciousness, things didn't get separated out. You wouldn't think about good versus evil. You just wouldn't think in those kind of polarized terms. You would think in terms of figure eights, with day flowing into night, life flowing into death, and the qualities, even the things of what is the good is not a category that really enters people's radar screens much before, you know, it really begins to articulate. Here, almost exactly with the arising of what people call the first axial for the planet, where around the world in that period from about 800 BC to 200 BC, all over the world, light bulbs seemed to get on. You had Zoroaster, you had the Old Testament, the psalmists and the prophets of exile. You had the Buddha. You had the moral teachers stepping forward to raise the questions of what's good and evil. Is there evil? Is there? And along with that, that rise of a sense of an individual being in individual relationship with God. These are very, very new concepts. And it's in this seedbed that the whole ontology of evil as we know it, the theology of evil, and most of our formatory thinking about evil has taken shape. And so a lot of the questions that we berate ourselves about and just pull our hair out are you know, sort of no-win questions, because they're tied inexorably to the structure of consciousness we're using to solve the problem, to our view of the world. And as both Gebser and I think Gurdjieff in his own way suggest, that the middle structure of consciousness, which has created the paradox of evil in the first place, is not going to be strong enough to solve that paradox. That help has to come in a different direction. And while the directions are languaged differently, they have an interesting dialectic with each other. For Gebser, it would say that the remediation of this comes at the next level of, or the next structure of consciousness, which is waiting in the wings and actually trying to emerge. But it's had a good hard time. It's been stuck in the birth canal for a good long time. But I think this is not atypical of the emergence. We're at the shifting of some tectonic plates of consciousness. And we cannot underestimate the significance of that for everything that the human race is going through right now. So Gebser speaks much about the integral structure of consciousness, which is not some new level attained, but is a way of, it's like another dimension comes on in your brain, where before you were seeing in two dimensions, and all of a sudden you're seeing in three. It's as dramatic as the old novella about flatlands, where all the people are only thinking in 2D. Somebody comes in and tries to describe the experience of depth, and it's a whole new dimension that people can't think in yet. So the integral structure adds a whole new dimension in which the other structures aren't canceled out, but they're brought into a distinct new relationship with each other, with something holding, so that we might be able to get back some of the beauty of the mythic sense of things always flowing and interchanging. We wouldn't have these jerky, staccato dividings of the field that are characteristic of our phase of consciousness and make everything more painful. And from the Gurdjieffian map of the worlds, what Gebser is describing as the integral corresponds very closely in its actual functioning with what I've been referring to from the maps of the world as World 24, imaginal causality. It's faster, it's more integrated, far more forceful. Time, causality work in very different directions. And in this kind of a structure, you've got, it's like bringing a whole new dimension online. Things move in different ways, and things are able to lock into place together that couldn't lock in when you had a system that couldn't accommodate them. So that's basically what I'm finding, that I think the structures, both sociological, theological, and psychological, that we're using to try and think about evil in our own World 48 are not strong enough to actually speak to or see what happens. Real evil, one of the reasons I think that so many people for so long tend to project it as an external force is because it really has its roots in worlds well beyond us. In these maps, I know in our first wisdom school in Claymont, we looked at how the seeds of what will eventually emerge as evil in this world, we call it evil, we arm ourselves against it, have their roots all the way back in the headwaters of World 3, which is at the dawn and the dawn of the creativeness, when the divine willingness to manifest, or yearning to manifest, or intention to manifest, and needing to figure out some way to get out of this divine equilibrium where nothing can manifest, has to apply a fundamental pressure of constriction and coagulation, you know, a pulling, a sucking, which is the characteristic signature, vibrational signature of evil across all the worlds. And in each world, evil manifests differently under different laws, but it has, you taste it by the sucking all to yourself, you know, and that's the story that we tell mythologically in the Bible about when we talk about the fall of Lucifer. You know, he was the bright, shiny, good angel, but he couldn't just be content with that. He wanted to have all the power. He wanted to have all the glory. He wanted, so you can feel the sucking motion is, that sucks all things unto yourself. And with that comes the capacity for enthrallment, which is the other great signature feature of evil. So these things play out consistently across all worlds, and they have a long, long energetic track record, so that we can't just deal with evil as a World 48 sociological problem. It doesn't work that way, because people have gotten hurt by bad parents and are victims, or because a few people wind up, you know, with screws loose in their brains. Through genetics, through trauma, through, you know, we can't just say that, well, that's where evil starts, because it's already running in other worlds on parallel tracks. And what happens is that when things get us to a certain instability in this world, the two come into sync, and evil in this world receives a convergence and a boost from the far stronger forces and configurations that it has in World 24, you know, 12, on. And if we can't deal with the maps of the world, if we think we're dealing with a problem that's essentially man-made, we're crazy. We get upended every time, blindsided. So this is a little bit of what I mean with a new map, that we have to expand the map, both in terms of our consciousness, and in terms of our metaphysics of the worlds, the vastness and scale of the universe, if we're going to be able to actually see how the roots of evil begin to take hold, you know, how it begins to get a foothold in the stuff, the garden variety stuff, the pain, the suffering, the yearning of this world, and then takes shape in this certain form that as it gets more and more configured, it becomes more and more powerful, variegated, intentional, manifest. It's sort of like a cancer when it starts with little streams and little bits and pieces of cells that are just kind of acting out. It doesn't look like much. But when it begins to develop a kind of cumulative force, you've got a force to reconcile with, and it can take the host down, as we know only too well.
That's so helpful, Cynthia. Thank you for that. And, you know, I'm curious, you're touching in on this, that something beyond our usual notions of, you know, being able to love the evil away out of some, you know, or in a situation, or, you know, in a relationship, can often bring us to get in over our head. And you spoke about authority and not necessarily authority over, but a deep inner authority that comes from, you know, building that second body or Kejian body, that body that can operate in world 24. But it's so easy for authority to devolve to a world 48 and below level. So can you say more about this deep inner authority and maybe why we need to cultivate that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the only stance that will hold its own with evil in world 48 in the encounter with it and won't be destroyed. That if you want to start with it, you can start with that encounter with Jesus and the centurion, and where the centurion says to the Jesus, he says, "I see that you too are one under authority." And that other quote about how Jesus speaks with authority, not like the scribes and Pharisees, not like the formatory thinking of the scribes and Pharisees of the tradition of his time. This inner authority, really, from my point of view, has to do with touching the wellsprings of real I, as Gurdjieff would call it. Touching the wellsprings of who you are in World 24. And it's not formatory. It's not based on book learning or passing on any untested ideas whatsoever. And it grows out of a three-centered presence in your own being that's not frightened and not hookable. And as we've seen, and one thing across the traditions, and for ages, that everyone, whether they're evangelicals, fundamentalists, liberal progressives, exorcists, are all in agreement that evil does not respond to positive psychology. It responds only to authority. Evil can and must be commanded. But commanded in a way that we don't understand in this world, because we're all so messed up now about authority is bad, because authority is authoritarianism, and that's the start of systemic evil. So we only have to eliminate all authority and we eliminate evil. Crazy. You have to bring in the right authority, which is not the oppressive and controlling and ordering authority that comes from a diminished being trying to look bigger, but the natural authority that flows from the master, as it were, from the one who has attained what a human being is capable of attaining and expected to attain, actually to be useful in the cosmos. And all they have to do is speak, and listening happens. And remember, when Jesus was casting out demons, he had only to speak and they flee. You know, the very obedient, they recognized evil tends to be very, very obedient to authority, the right kind of authority, which is the one hook. It does not deal kindly with authority that's coming from all the places that we like to hate here, because those are mowed over. And as I say, it does not respond to positive psychology, which is where the church gets itself blindsided over and over and over again, that something deeper is needed in a being in order to be able to walk forward and stand in the face of evil and not be destroyed, even if you're killed.
Yeah, you're bringing this clarification for us, Cynthia, and it feels like it is a continued weaving of this wisdom path and the path of the work. And I'm just wondering if there's anything else you want to name into the space that we haven't touched on that feels important around engaging evil from this wisdom lens?
Well, I did do a lot of talking in the classes, and in fact, in all the teaching I've been doing this year, the building second body courses and the relearning trust, about the importance of martyrdom and of conscience as real ways that we learn to stand our ground with this inner authority, and this is where the classic contemplative path ties in with what we're doing nowadays with the wisdom work, that the whole idea of being able to die before you die, the whole ability in yourself to say, whether I live or die, I am the Lord's. If you can truly say that, not just as a statement of creed, but as something you can live and walk, you have inner authority. And inner authority and evil sort of jumps and makes contagion by overriding people's conscience. They don't take personal responsibility. They allow themselves to be sucked into something that's just, once again, sucking itself back into that Luciferian place. And they allow their conscience to be overridden, basically because they're afraid. There's a sense of lack. There's a sense of need. There's a sense of something outside of myself can give it to me and must give it to me. Otherwise, I'm not complete. And these practices that have to do with dying before you die, with letting go of self, with taking up your cross and following me, as Jesus calls it, have to do with reaching that place where your conscience can't be hooked. There are no more hooks. And when there are no more hooks, evil can't grab. I mean, it can paste and blast and polarize, but it can't grab. And when evil can't grab, the sucking motion is broken, even by a single human being. So the capacity to live in ourself with such courage and virginity and abundance, whether I live or die, I am the Lord's, is a statement that comes from World 12. And it will, God love them, trump evil every time. Because these are the sources of the wellsprings of authority. As long as we're afraid to die, evil has a lien on us. We will sell our birthright for a mess of pottage. It's just the way it is in the human condition. And I don't think it's worth time saying, calling that sinful self-will. We're set up that way. It's the default World 48 programming. And it gives us a chance, though, and it's the chance that all the great contemplatives and mystics of all traditions have taken, to dive right through that wave and see what life lives on the other side. If you can reach a place where truly you are unafraid to die, not just in some sort of bravado, but in the deepest way that yourself is structured, so that I and me are not grasping to each other for dear life, but that something becomes possible in simply being. And this is an act of grace, and it comes usually only just for a little while in a person, and then maybe it stays. I think in the same way that evil can snowball, good can. And, you know, and your father's coming to mind in my head, Janine, as we're talking about this beautiful, uncooptable Baptist minister who stood his ground with civil rights and with human justice through some tough times in the South, with this beautiful freedom of soul, without being angry, without being dismissive or punitive, without hating his enemies. I mean, when you look at Mahan Seiler, you're talking about what I mean about authority. Mm. And it's a kind of authority. And as we have that, you can't get that. You can't cheat to get that. You get that to the measure that you know that whether I live or die, I am the Lord's. And therefore, the world has no liens on me. Does that sound right, Janet? You know your daddy better than me, but
that's beautiful, Cynthia. I, you know, you've talked before about finding the person that you sort of look to like an icon that you emulate, and that by studying that person or by finding yourself synchronizing or resonating, that's one of the ways we learn to find that inner authority in ourselves. And so that's a beautiful.
But it becomes really, really important to emulate from the inside,
yes,
not from the outside.
Exactly.
We talk about understudying and drama, because when you're understudying, you don't just copy the behaviors. That's all formatory.
That's right.
You got to say. Beatrice Bruto used to say, I don't know why Christians are so squeamish about imitating Jesus. They say, I mean, what better thing to do? Take the role of Jesus in the play and play it. And as you learn to play it from the inside, not just from the outside with your white halo and your white robes, when you learn to play it from the inside, where you have to call forth from your own resources, I will not hate, I will not kill, I will not, you know, when you have to bring that forth in yourself, then you're learning something.
That's right.
So I would say, if you want to talk about practices, that's a great one. Centering prayer remains really, really basic, because all practice that gets you close to, you know, as Thomas Keating calls it, taking a brief vacation from yourself, so that you're not hanging on for dear life. In any passage where you become uncooptable, even if it's only for a 20-minute sit, you're learning something. And of course, the work and the exercises that increase our awareness of our inner body, our Kesjan aliveness already within us, and allow us to cut through all the scenarios and the master charts and the lesson plans that we've learned in World 48, that just are like a rickety scaffolding at this point. It's going to blow over. And what will stand is the buildings that we have built of our own souls in the process of honest and loving, compassionate growth.
Wow. Well, you've already touched a bit on these different practices. So just to summarize a bit of that, what we're hearing is that any practice that will continue to help us stabilize that Kesjan self, that second body, empower that and strengthen that, and in particular around really becoming comfortable with whether I live or die, I am the Lord's. You've also mentioned, you know, any of the Gurdjieff exercises. Atmosphere was one that you brought up in particular, as well as creating sun and creating moon, which you've touched on with this emulating, imitating from the inside. So if there's anything else you wanted to say about that, Cynthia, I invite that. But then also just wondering if you would maybe lead us in that embodied sign of the cross practice from the Eastern Orthodox tradition that you led us in, if you'd feel comfortable with that.
Well, it gives us a little bit of working on that if you start very clearly, of course, for the Orthodox, the cross is made backwards from what most of the West does. In the West, you do, you know, so fast you don't even know what you're doing. In the East, it's Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and it goes from right to left, which means that it ends on your heart. And so the practice we worked with was just as you begin to do it, not to make the sign of the cross just as something you routinely do as you go into a church door or something like that, but to actually embody and sense, allow your head for the moment to be the repository of the energy, the goodness, the first person of the Trinity. Feel the connection, sense the connection with your head and Father. Sense the connection as you move down. And we all think it's in the front, but it's actually front and back. Down the spine. Down the spinal column. Holy the firm, they called Jesus. Holy the firm one, the backbone of creation. And to sense that vertical descent for us and for our salvation. He descended from heaven. And to sense, as your own back becomes alive, the presence of Christ, the backbone within. And then crossing yourself beautifully, allowing yourself to drift across this whole region, not just hot to get to the heart, which is so much of what we do because we think it's the emotions, but this whole beautiful region of the solar plexus, where not only does our heart beat, but we take in air, and the lower and the upper regions of our body are connected and in continuous intimate dialogue, this wonderful marrow, and to allow that to be associated in us with Holy Spirit, Agios Athanatos, as they call it in Greek, Holy the Undying One, and to cross yourself, not only invoking the persons of the Trinity consciously, but representing to yourself that they actually, that each of these sacred members, which are also the centers of your own, you know, three-centered awareness, represent the three persons of the Trinity. You know, in the name of the Father, of the Son, of the Holy Spirit. And that you've just thereby designated the law of world creation, the law of three, how things come into being. And it's a beginning, it's a very, very basic first footstep towards really understanding that authority within you, not as something that comes from the outside, like because you've gotten your titles and your ranks, but it emerges by virtue of the fact of the divine action, which is acting in everything through the law of three in every nanosecond, is acting in you as well and connecting you with all worlds. And as that strengthens your ability to stand in the face of evil, which is basically swimming in the wrong direction, will increase. So my sense is that what we can basically do as the wisdom community is, first of all, to guard the shapes of our mind, to guard our atmosphere, so we don't get pulled out of shape by all the latest emotions rattling through, the fear, the polarization, the stories, to really keep that beautiful roundness, to keep the mind open, spacious, to not get hooked in your story, not get hooked in your drama, all the things you tell yourself about your personal narrative or fairy tale anyway. So take some moment to abide in that which is deeper than your own fairy tale, and to hold that atmosphere. And as you do that, and as we will become in the world a beginning container of temperance, you know, a kind of holy the reconciling to these radically polarized edges of everything that's just escalating the rate and the intensity of evil, that to hold equanimity, not a kind of Pollyanna equanimity. Oh, God's going to take us all. It's all going to be okay. It's all going to be you. I have Jesus. All right. Not that kind of stuff. But the equanimity of the The person whose feet is planted so deep in the earth that you don't get buffeted about, that kind of equanimity. And that nothing will get you up in your mind where you're sort of precarious and unbalanced. I'm here. This is what's required. I'm here. The more we hold that, the more that becomes a contagion throughout a very alarmed and frightened and confused, terrified, population. It's helping because the fear is real, the heartbreak is real, the confusion is real, and we hold it not by sort of trying to placate it with words, but by trying to bring in of ourselves be an energy that transmits a different possibility, not in what we say, but in how we are present.
This is such a gift to our community, to our network. Cynthia, thank you for taking this time for us to be able to record this for the larger group. Such a gift. Very great.
And I hope that for all of you, even if you don't come to one of the on-the-ground wisdom schools that we're going to be doing with this, that at some point or another, this will be produced into a course, whether audio or video, and available through the Wisdom Network. And it is an ongoing work in progress. So certainly join in the sessions that are available to you and in the facilities that we now have on the Wisdom Waypoints Network for interaction, for conversation, for study together, because it's the insights that have come from all of you that have already strengthened and deepened my own thinking on this. I'm just very much the figurehead on the bow of this boat. And it's the whole boat that's going to take us somewhere. Nobody ever gets to a destination by the bow alone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.